Listen only mode.
Welcome to today's JNEB webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB, and so glad to have you with us today for this special presentation. A little bit of housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the handout tab of your GoToWebinar toolbar, you'll see the slides for today's presentation so that you can download those, take notes as you follow along. We will take questions after the presenters have finished, so please type those in the question box so we can moderate those to our panelists. We have a very large audience today, so if for some reason we do not get to all the questions that are asked, we will do a follow-up email out to attendees to address any of those questions. There will be a survey when I close the webinar today, and we appreciate your feedback on this session as well as ideas for future webinars. And I mentioned the follow-up email. So you will see a follow-up email on Thursday of this week with a link to the recording that we're making today, the handout again, as well as a CEU certificate for your attendance. I do know there's some locations that have multiple listeners, and if you are welcome to share that CEU certificate with the folks that are listening today so they can get credit for this presentation as well. So I'd like to introduce our moderator for the presentation. Madeline Sigman Grant is Associate Editor of the Journal of Nutrition Education and Behavior, is also Professor at Emeritus at the University of Nevada, Reno.
Thank you, Rachel. Hope everybody can hear me. And we're so excited about the number of people who are listening in today. So today we're going to be updating everyone about efforts within the WIC program to promote, support, and protect breastfeeding by reviewing some of the research and practice papers that were published in the recent JNEB supplement that was issued last week. So after I provide you with a brief overview of the process involved in getting this issue to press, we'll have the opportunity to hear from the lead authors of two of the publications. We've left ample time for your questions and answers, so I actually will be following Dr. Rasmussen and Dr. Whaley after their talks. And if there's enough time, I'll highlight a few of the other papers that have been included that can help serve as evidence and practice for others involved in the promotion, protection, and support of breastfeeding. Okay, let me see. Having trouble here. There we go, one more. I need to tell you that this the supplement was sponsored in part by they also provided us with a commentary that is published in this supplement on a historical perspective of the WIC program. And I have to just on a personal note, I was involved with WIC in the early days in the 1970s and 1980s, and FNS was very gracious and helped us improve our packets for breastfeeding women, and they have been supportive from the beginning. So let me move on to how this process, I am having trouble going, let me go back. Okay, about a year ago at the last meeting, last year's annual meeting for SNEB, I was asked to become the guest editor for this special supplement. The call for papers was released a month later in August, and by January we had over 35 submissions. They were every type of paper that JNEB publishes, our research articles and briefs, reports, perspectives, and even GEMS, which are great, are our great educational materials. We selected 12 peer-reviewed papers. And we're really, really pleased that we will be publishing additional papers that were submitted for the supplement in future issues of JNEB. And we want to encourage you that if you are doing research and or practice, please submit your work to JNEB. We'd be very, very happy to publish them, or at least put them through the review process. Our first speaker, I'm going to present both speakers together. Our first speaker will be Dr. Kathleen Rasmussen. Dr. Rasmussen is the Nancy Meinig Professor of Maternal and Child Nutrition at the Division of Nutritional Sciences, Cornell University. Relevant to this presentation, Dr. Rasmussen served as the chair of the committee to revise the WIC food packages at the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, which released that report in January 2017. Her research is focused on maternal and child nutrition, with an emphasis on the breastfeeding mother. Recently, she and her students have been investigating why heavier women have less success with breastfeeding than lighter women. They've also been investigating the now widespread practice of milk expression and how this practice affects the duration of feeding human milk, whether it's from the bottle or the breast. Currently, she is a member of the technical evaluation group gathered to develop the background necessary to cover pregnant women for the 2020 Dietary Guidelines for Americans. Dr. Whaley is the Director of Research and Evaluation. I'm using two screens, guys, so. Is the Director of Research and Evaluation for the Public Health Foundation Enterprises, which is located in Southern California. Dr. Whaley's expertise is in the planning, design, and evaluation of programs to optimize the healthy development of children and families served by WIC. Her work spans a broad range of topics, including childhood nutrition and obesity, prevention of prenatal alcohol use, promotion of early literacy for low-income children, and examination of the impact of the recent WIC food package change on WIC participants. Dr. Whaley has served on a number of advisory boards related to early childhood, and she also works closely with both the California and National WIC associations. I would like to remind you again before I turn the presentation over to Dr. Rasmussen, please feel free to enter your questions as the presenters are speaking, and we will get to your questions as soon as we follow after Dr. Whaley's talk. So I will turn it over now to Dr. Rasmussen.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm not used to this system either, and I am clicking on the screen and I am not getting my slides. So Rachel, can you make that work, please? There we go. Thank you very much. That's a big help. So I appreciate the opportunity to describe our article from the supplement to the recent journal supplement titled New Opportunities for Breastfeeding Promotion, Review of WIC Food Packages, Improving Balance and Choice. And my co-authors on this work are Dr. Whaley, Dr. Perez Escamilla, Dr. Catherine Ross, Susan Baker, Tamara Hatfield, and Marie Latulippe. This is a subset of the members of the committee that prepared the report and its study director. Okay. Here we go. Now I get it. So I'd like to begin with some disclaimers. You may not notice it, but this set of slides has no logos on it. And that's because it's not an official presentation of the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine, and represents the views of the individual authors, that is the subset of the committee that got together and wrote the article. This gives me permission, this disclaimer, to use causal language and say WIC will do this and that, but in truth, these food packages are not this article and the book from which it's drawn is nothing of the sort. They are, in fact, recommendations to USDA, which may or may not choose to adopt them. Of course, we hope they will, but it is USDA's choice. So I'd like to begin by telling you some of the key things that the committee recommended with respect to breastfeeding, and then we'll look at how we got to that position. Now, when I begin to tell you about breastfeeding in the proposed packages, I have to issue another disclaimer. And that is, the recommended changes to the food packages by themselves are not sufficient to improve breastfeeding initiation and continuation. But they do serve as incentives to breastfeed. To get real change, more is going to be needed than changes to the breastfeeding packages. And the committee did speak to that, and I'll come to that later. Now, to make it easier to understand what we did, I've prepared this cheat sheet to the food packages. The committee recommended a gradation in the components for the packages for women to reflect the differences in caloric needs of women who are breastfeeding from women who are not breastfeeding. So if we start in the bottom center with postpartum women, these are women with the lowest caloric and nutritional needs postpartum because they're feeding their babies formula exclusively and they're not making any milk, at least not for the purposes of this discussion. The other components of the package that are not listed here are the same across these three groups. So the postpartum women get a $15 cash value voucher each month to buy fresh vegetables and fruits. They get no juice in this new package, a dozen eggs, and 10 ounces of fish every month. In comparison, the partially breastfeeding women in the top right get $10 more of CVV, 64 additional ounces of juice, and they get three times the amount of fish in a three monthly rotation. And finally, the exclusively breastfeeding women get the most generous package of a $35 cash value voucher, $20 more than for the postpartum women, the same 64 ounces of juice as the partially breastfeeding women, but they get double the eggs at two dozen and double the fish at 60 ounces for every 3 months. Now, we also, the committee also spoke to breastfeeding in the packages. And the committee's vision for breastfeeding was that WIC should provide breastfeeding counseling for all pregnant women and all postpartum women who wish to breastfeed at any intensity. Funding for this package, for this level of counseling, does not come from the same source as the food packages, but it is a separate budget allocation. Moreover, funding for this is not uniformly available nationally. Therefore, the committee recommended that the Food and Nutrition Service at USDA should acquire adequate and consistent funding for peer counseling and other breastfeeding support that might be necessary to meet this vision of counseling for all pregnant women and all postpartum women who wish to breastfeed at any intensity. Moreover, in the first month, the consultation will continue to be required for breastfeeding women before formula can be provided. Now, again, I'm using causal language here, assuming USDA is going to adopt the committee's recommendations, which, as I disclaimed earlier, may not be the case. However, if needed, the committee recommended that more than one can of formula be allowed in the first month, which is all that's allowed in some states now, up to 50% of the full formula amount, and only after a consultation. And I understand this is going to make more sense to those of you who provide WIC services now, and I'll speak more about this later. I just wanted to highlight the changes at this point. I also want to say a few words about formula feeding in the proposed packages. For those mothers who are not breastfeeding, their infant's full need for formula will continue to be met from birth to 6 months. This addresses a concern about infant health, that if mothers cannot or do not wish to breastfeed, no alternative foods are available or appropriate for infants less than 6 months old. It also addresses a concern about cost, namely that it's more effective for WIC to purchase formula than for poor families to do so. And we have to remember that it is still true, even after all the fiddling this committee did, that the market value of formula, which is the perceived value in the communities that must buy formula, the market value of the dyadic packages, that's the total of the package for the mother plus the package for the infant, the dyadic package for the formula-fed infants and their mothers still exceeds that of those packages for the breastfed infant. That was not something the committee could change. So we wrote the article that appears in the supplement because we recognize that some of the committee's recommendations might be counterintuitive or at least unexpected. We hoped that the article that we published there would help the WIC committee and others interested in breastfeeding to understand our logic. And so now I'm going to give you a short version of that logic. The last time the food packages were revised was in 2006. That was the first time they'd ever been revised. And those changes were implemented by WIC in 2009. And in those changes, no formula was permitted in the first month for women who were breastfeeding. The idea behind this was that this was to support the choice to breastfeed exclusively. There was no partial breastfeeding option in the first month. And when faced with this recommendation, some states decided to allow issuance of one can of formula in the first month. So that's about 1/9 of the amount of formula an infant might need in the first month. When this was studied nationally in 17 sites by Park Wilde and co-workers for the reference that you see at the bottom of your slide, what they found was a modest 2-month increase in exclusive breastfeeding, a substantial and sustained reduction in partial breastfeeding, and a large and immediate increase in fully formula feeding, which was not really the outcome that the 2006 committee had in mind, unfortunately. We think that this occurred because some women may not be confident enough in their ability to breastfeed for exclusive breastfeeding to seem or to actually be feasible. And with no middle ground, they gave up on breastfeeding and went to formula. Other women may want to breastfeed, but partial breastfeeding is the only option for them because of their social or working conditions. No formula in the first month is a no-go for them. So they went to fully formula feeding. These, as I say, are clearly not the intended outcomes, but it's where we were when the committee began its work. The committee thinks that partial breastfeeding is really important for WIC. Many more WIC women have the potential for successful partial breastfeeding than exclusive breastfeeding. That is not to say that WIC women cannot exclusively breastfeed. They most certainly can, and WIC has definitely proved that it's possible. But there are many factors that may preclude exclusive breastfeeding when partial breastfeeding is still possible. Partial breastfeeding may be more socially acceptable than exclusive breastfeeding, and partial breastfeeding may be easier for working women without adequate maternity leave or workplace support for breastfeeding. Thus, improved support for partial breastfeeding addresses a missed opportunity for WIC. Now, it's also important to know that partial breastfeeding costs WIC's budget less than full formula feeding because formula is expensive and less of it is provided to the infant in this package, the partially breastfeeding package. Partial breastfeeding is also important to WIC because it's already supported by WIC, and it requires both similar and different support. All women must learn to breastfeed and thus need support before delivery to make the choice to breastfeed, as well as after delivery to get breastfeeding started successfully. Partially breastfeeding women need support to integrate breastfeeding with formula feeding, and if they're working, also with milk expression, which is often required. Proximal incentives for breastfeeding are helpful, and we heard this in the testimony that we took in developing the report. And we took that to heart and created improvement in the food package for partially breastfeeding women. So now I'd like to turn to how WIC could make support for partial breastfeeding work. And the committee had some ideas about this, and I'll share them here. The major fear with partial breastfeeding is that formula interferes with the establishment of breastfeeding. If your goal is exclusive, you don't want formula in the middle of that. So there are some possible solutions, especially when you understand that the woman you're working with may be headed for partial breastfeeding. You begin with individual counseling of all women who wish to breastfeed at any intensity, and then work with them to figure out what the desired intensity is. For those who prefer partial breastfeeding, the idea is to determine the amount of formula actually needed and provide formula only up to this amount. So this is tailoring a formula, and the amount that they can get maximally is half the amount that would be provided to a fully formula-fed baby. And when it exceeds that, as today, that baby would move to the fully formula-fed package. Third, to provide support for the first 30 days postpartum, and particularly in the first 7 days for continued breastfeeding, because women who abandon breastfeeding early very early. in the first few days, the first 7 days, the first 2 weeks. It's very soon. So being ready to give women immediate support for breastfeeding is just essential. And of course, we provided an improved package for partially breastfeeding women to support their choice, so they were more involved in this. To make partial breastfeeding work, there's also a major challenge, and that is nationally, there are not enough lactation counselors, and they're not adequately represented in WIC. WIC's direct support for breastfeeding is primarily done by its frontline staff and is enhanced with peer counselors where funding is available for them, but their support is not guaranteed and fluctuates annually. So the committee recommended that USDA FNS maximize the extent to which the revised packages motivate the choice to breastfeed, and we certainly tried to help them do that, we being the committee, by stabilizing the funding available for peer counseling and for other lactation support staff at WIC sites. So let's turn to the bottom line here, which is that WIC is pivotal for breastfeeding in the U.S. More than half of all U.S. infants receive WIC benefits. Thus, how breastfeeding goes in WIC determines how well low-income women meet breastfeeding goals. Low-income women experience many barriers to breastfeeding that WIC cannot address. Therefore, it is essential that WIC address those barriers that it can with its food packages and breastfeeding support activity. And this means helping all women with any desire to breastfeed achieve at least their own breastfeeding goals. Thank you very much.
All right, this is Shannon. Look at that, it worked. Kathy, I could listen to you all day long. Thank you for your presentation of the committee's work and our paper. And I'm gonna shift tracks a little bit, but of course we're not leaving breastfeeding in WIC. And I'll be talking about our paper called Breastfeeding is Associated with Reduced Obesity in Hispanic 2 to 5 year olds Served by WIC. I wanna start with a special shout out to my co-authors. This is such a group process. As you'll see, we have a lot of data and do a lot of sifting, and there are a lot of people involved in this work. So thank you to Maria, Stephanie, and Mike in particular, and to many others who I will talk about later. So how did we come to want to explore the association between breastfeeding and obesity? There is quite a big literature on this. And when we started thinking about doing this work, it was actually back in 2009, 2010, and the literature has been quite mixed on, you know, is breastfeeding associated with early childhood obesity? Is it not associated? How large is this association? One really nice study came out in 2015 by Horta et al. That was a really lovely systematic review of 105 studies and concluded that breastfeeding decreased the odds of obesity in early childhood, actually in childhood, by about 13%. It's a really lovely study. For those of you interested in this field, I highly recommend it. But what you find when you look at that study, as well as all the literature, is there remains very limited evidence on Hispanic families and whether this association between breastfeeding and childhood obesity holds among the Hispanic population in the United States. The reason this concerns us is that the rates of obesity are highest among Hispanic children. You can see on this slide that childhood obesity rates vary quite substantially by racial ethnic group. You can see Hispanic kids have the highest rates of obesity. This slide is showing the rates of 2 to 18 year olds. So slightly higher than the WIC age group, but it does start early. You see that the white population is at the lowest risk here. Actually, the Asian population has a slightly lower risk than any of the other groups as well. So the reason that we were real interested in the Hispanic families is that while obesity rates are the highest, the other rates that are highest are actually breastfeeding rates. Hispanic women do tend to breastfeed. They are more likely to breastfeed, they're more likely to initiate breastfeeding. However, they're also more likely to combination feed both breast milk and formula. And there's some evidence that this group introduces solid food somewhat earlier. So it was quite a quandary for us. We've got a group of women who are more successful at breastfeeding, but also we're seeing higher obesity rates. So that led us to ask the question, what's the association between breastfeeding and obesity in a Hispanic population? And welcome to California. That's the large proportion of our participants here are from the Hispanic ethnic group. And what Kathy just said, thank you, over half of all infants born in the United States come to WIC. So we felt that WIC would be a good place to explore this question. So let me talk about the data that we have at WIC. So what WIC data do we have here? As Madeline mentioned in my introduction, I'm with Public Health Foundation Enterprises WIC program. We happen to be a really, really big program here in Los Angeles, serving more than 200,000 participants every month. So very quickly, we see a lot of kids, and we see them for a really long time. So this study was a sample of almost 40,000 infants who were on WIC from birth, and we were able to follow for quite a few years. You have just learned from Kathy about the 2009 food package changes. All of these kiddos were actually born before 2009. So that can make us all feel like we don't have a problem here of wondering if the food package change happened in the middle of this study. These kiddos were all born before 2009. What WIC does then is we talk a lot about breastfeeding and we talk a lot about kids' heights and weights. So we have a lot of data on breastfeeding and kids' heights and weights. So before we embarked on our regression analyses, where we really dove into examining the associations between early breastfeeding and later obesity, we wanted to make sure that the measures we were using were valid. So we started in 2010 with a study, of about 2,000 postpartum moms. What we did is we called them by phone and asked them, how are you feeding her baby? And I know a lot of you on the webinar right now have done breastfeeding research and are intimately aware of how difficult it can be to find out exactly what moms are doing. So it was about a 20-minute survey with lots of coding to really determine, okay, are moms really just breastfeeding? Are they combination feeding? Are they just formula feeding, et cetera? What we were then able to do is link their survey data to the food package they were issued in that same month. And you just learned from Kathy, we have three food packages. Although currently the partial breastfeeding package does not look like the one she just showed you, we do have a partial breastfeeding package. So those three packages are the full breastfeeding package, the partial breastfeeding package, and the full formula package. So what we did in this study is just confirmed that what she said she was doing matched the package that we were issuing her. And in fact, as you can see on this slide, we had some really nice rates of correspondence between what they told us they were doing, yes, I'm fully breastfeeding, and we're actually being issued a full breastfeeding package. So based on that study that we published in 2012, we do feel that infant food packages are a valid indicator of the feeding behavior going on at home. The second study then is how confident are we in our heights and weights? And the good news is that we're very confident. So we were able to do a study of about 287 2 to 5-year-olds at our site, comparing our WIC staff measurements to gold standard measurements. And for any of you who have spent time weighing 2 to 5-year-old children, you know that they're not always eager to jump on a scale. And for this study, they had to do it twice, and our WIC staff didn't know why. So it was quite a fun study, but thank you to Mei Wang and her research team for helping us with this. As you can see from the conclusion, we had very high interclass correlations, and we feel actually quite good about the validity of our height and weight data. These numbers are on par or better than what is seen in pediatric practices. So we're feeling quite confident in our WIC height and weight measurements. So with those two studies done, we were able to proceed to doing some modeling on looking at associations between breastfeeding behavior and outcome childhood obesity outcomes among our kiddos. Okay, so what this slide shows you is our sample, just shy of 40,000 kids. Most of you probably know the WIC income threshold is 185% of the poverty level. So all of our kids are in low-income families. Close to 73% are in families below 100% of the federal poverty level. As you can see here, 88% of our sample is Hispanic, 40% preferred English, close to 24% of our kids were obese at ages 2 to 5. As determined having a BMI greater than or equal to 95th percentile. Family size is about 4.4 people, and our moms are heavy. The mean BMI is 28, with 38% of moms being overweight and 32% being obese. So what do we find? Here comes the fun stuff. I'm going to walk you through this slide that actually should say at ages 2 to 5, not at age four. So I apologize for my mix up in my typo here. So we'll fix that hopefully for the handouts for those of you who download those. But let's start with the first bar. These are kiddos that were issued a full formula package from WIC when they enrolled right after birth. So we're calling this breastfeeding initiation. And in this case, these are kiddos that may have had a little breast milk at the hospital, but by the time they were enrolling in WIC, were not breastfeeding any longer and getting a full formula package. And you can see from that first bar that 26% of those kiddos at age 2 to 5 are obese. The second bar is showing you our partial breastfeeding or combination package issuance. So these are the kiddos who, when they were born and came in, got the partial package from WIC. And let's not get too confused with Kathy's last presentation, because back in this time, you could get a combination package with up to 5 cans, or up to 4 cans, pardon me, of formula. So these kiddos have an obesity rate at ages 2 to 5 of 24.5%. Finally, moving to the right, are the kids who came in getting the full breastfeeding package when they enrolled in WIC. So you see a lower obesity risk of 19.1% of those kids. So two comments here. First of all three bars are statistically significantly different. But for those of you who do data analysis, you probably know quickly that when you have a sample size of 40,000, just about anything becomes statistically significant. So I would argue that these are also very practically significant differences. The other takeaway is that even at 19%, that's still a pretty high obesity rate. So while we're seeing an attenuation of childhood obesity, we haven't yet found the magic bullet. So let's then move on to breastfeeding duration. Let's see if it, there we go. So this is a detailed slide. I'm going to walk you through the components, and we'll start then right here with this circle. We have two models. We did regression models with any breastfeeding. And what I mean by any breastfeeding is she's doing at least some breastfeeding and may also be giving formula at some point. What I mean by full breastfeeding is she took a full breastfeeding package from WIC throughout. So as far as we know, she did not introduce formula. We've used the term full breastfeeding instead of the term exclusive breastfeeding because we can't be sure that formula never touched the lips of these babes. But in terms of how we have defined full breastfeeding, they never took any formula from WIC. So what this 0.99 odds ratio tells us is that for every additional month of any breastfeeding, we see a 1% reduction in the rate of obesity at ages 2 to 5. So every month of any breastfeeding, 1% reduction in obesity. So I'll test you out here. If you see a 0.97, what that means is that for every additional month of full breastfeeding, we see a 3% reduction in obesity at ages 2 to 5. So any breastfeeding, 1% per month, full breastfeeding, 3% per month. So it seems clear here we also have something going on with dose. So the more, the better. The more any breastfeeding you get is great. The more full breastfeeding you get is even better. And the longer you go with either has a positive influence on your obesity outcomes, with obesity rates lowering for every month of any and every month of full breastfeeding. Of course, other things matter. So this next slide, there we go, highlights some of the other demographic factors that we know might play a role. So of course, poverty. Kids from lower income households are showing higher rates of obesity later on. Hispanic kids, as we expected, have higher rates of obesity. Kids who are in English-speaking households are showing lower rates of obesity. And interestingly, a larger family size is associated with somewhat lower risk of obesity, with every additional family member associated with about an 8% decrease in childhood obesity. Finally, then, body mass index of mom, we can't overlook this. This is an important variable. What this shows is that for every additional point, sort of BMI point increase, so going from a 26 to a 27, for example, is associated with about a 9% increase in the child's obesity rate. This is important, I think, for a number of reasons. I am not an expert in this area. You heard from Kathy earlier, who happens to be an expert in this area and actually shared some of her work. I think Madeline mentioned that in her introduction, that it has been documented by Kathy and others that there are lower rates of breastfeeding among obese women. So there is certainly something to be explored there. We also know that there's potentially genetic predispositions as well as shared food environments going on. So there might be a number of factors associated with the association between a mom's body mass index and that of her infant. So in summary, I think there's really a growing literature right now that suggests that obesity prevention efforts are likely to have the greatest impact when they start early. We need to target infancy and early childhood and even prenatally and pre-pregnancy. These are the times when behaviors and physiologic characteristics really are the most elastic. We see that rates of obesity among Hispanic children are particularly high, even when they're breastfed, but this study suggests that breastfeeding does play a pivotal role in the attenuation of obesity in Hispanic children. And finally, you know, breastfeeding promotion and support are really a cornerstone of the WIC program. These are things that happen around the country. And I think this is plays an important contribution in lowering the obesity risk for children served by the program. So finally, I mentioned earlier that this is not a study done by one or four people, but by many. So a big shout out, I know my PHFE WIC team is listening, so yeehaw, thanks for joining. We have a terrific leader right now in Kiran Saluja and Judy Gomez, and Eloise Jenks was our former director, who was director at the time that we started this work. Pat Gradziel, I think, is listening in, thank you, at the state of California, and our former WIC director, Linnea Salek, in California. They've been instrumental partners in doing this kind of work with really large data sets using solely WIC administrative data. And finally, we're in a very unique partnership with our funder, First Five LA. They have given us a research partnership since 2002. And you all know it's really hard to fund research, particularly this kind of research. So we thank them tremendously for their ongoing contributions to this work. So I think now I'm kicking it back to Madeline for Q&A. And if you have any questions that you'd like to email me, please do. Thank you.
Yes, this is Madeline. Hope you all can hear me. Let me see if I have control of this. Okay. We have a few questions that have come in for both Dr. Rasmussen and Dr. Whaley. And I'd like to address those first before I talk a little bit about some of the other articles or papers that are in the supplement. So let me start with this first one. Kathy, I think this is directed to you. How is breastfeeding consultation currently administered? Isn't it already offered to all women in WIC, regardless of their package selection? Kathy?
Good. Now I'm not muted anymore. It's my understanding that it is WIC's objective to provide that level of breastfeeding counseling support, but that's not the reality nationally. Shannon, you know more about this than I do. If you want to add something to that, that would be helpful.
I agree with you, Kathy. It's certainly part of Nutrition Services Administration funding that all WIC sites and need to have staff available to provide breastfeeding support. There's mandated amounts of training for breastfeeding support that happens. So I think we can say that there should be at least a basic level of some breastfeeding support across the country. I think what becomes evident, and the NASEM committee had to travel out, all of us had to travel out to sites around the country. What becomes evident very quickly is that things, there's some variation in what's available from site to site, particular variation in what's available with peer counseling funding, which while it's touching many or most areas of the country, it's far from touching every individual participant who walks through the door. So I think, Kathy, you did a really nice job, and hopefully in the NASEM report, the whole committee did a reasonable job at highlighting, you know, the concern is the variability there. And that currently there doesn't seem to be enough funding available to, while the goal is to provide that support to every woman, the reality is that that's not always possible in the current funding scenario.
I think it's also worth thinking about that Sama women know about WIC while they're pregnant and choose to come while they're pregnant. Other women who know about WIC while they're pregnant have already decided they wish to feed formula, and they don't show up until after they deliver when they actually need the formula. So WIC, even in the best of circumstances, doesn't actually have the opportunity to counsel every woman who has a child born into WIC. That's just the flat reality of it.
Thank you. This is to Dr. Whaley. For your study, was education level adjusted for?
Yes, I'm glad you asked. I will go back and to the analysis because I didn't make a mention of that during the talk, but I'd be happy to respond to that in a written comment. Thank you for the question.
And also, is there any hypothesis on what factors are leading to higher obesity rates among Hispanic children, and what research might be recommended to provide further clarity?
Gosh, I love questions like this, and this is when I need all my colleagues, like Jamie Davis, who we've worked with, who really does some wonderful work on studying Hispanic children and why rates are so much higher among those groups. So I will speak very minimally to this because it's not my area of expertise, but it certainly does seem like there are certain biological differences between individuals. Jamie has done some work in how Hispanic children process sugar-sweetened beverages, for example. So it's a wonderful question. It is a bit far outside my area of expertise, but certainly one that where work is being done.
Yeah, and there's several other questions regarding your study that have come in, which I think for the sake of time, we'll have you address later after.
I'd be happy to do that, Madeline. Thanks.
Thank you. Dr. Rasmussen, you stated that partial breastfeeding may be more socially acceptable than exclusive breastfeeding. What is the research to support this?
Well, we know that in a number of low-income communities, and I'm not specific to WIC here, but that there isn't much breastfeeding for the social networks of a given woman. And if a woman is exclusively breastfeeding, she needs to be able to breastfeed in a large number of circumstances, including in her own home, where there may not be any private place to breastfeed. And if she lacks social support for breastfeeding, trying to breastfeed in a social situation is very challenging. So the social support really does begin at home with the father of the baby and the family with whom the woman is in close contact, and then it extends out from there to her social network. So the more intensely you wish to breastfeed, the more social support you need for it, or at least social permission.
Well, that actually leads us into a couple of the papers that are also included in the supplement. There are some other questions regarding your recommendations for the new WIC packet, but I think I'd like to move on at this point. We'll address these questions later if we have time at the end, but I do wish to present a little bit about, because this sort of fits into that social cultural support that low-income women need. This particular study used semi-structured scripts where they, along with some scales where they measured infant feeding attitude and breastfeeding self-efficacy in a small group of 15 first-time breastfeeding African-American women enrolled in WIC in Central Illinois. They interviewed, the mothers had a positive attitude towards breastfeeding and a relatively high level of self-efficacy. When they did their coding of the qualitative feedback that they got, they found six themes that describe both facilitators and barriers within the African-American community. And these included normative infant feeding behavior within a sociocultural context, cultural beliefs about maternal nutrition and breastfeeding, the time and cost associated with breastfeeding, managing and integrating breastfeeding while maintaining a social life, necessity of social support from significant others and female role models, and suboptimal support from institutions such as hospitals and schools. A novel finding from this particular study was that participants believed that breastfeeding was expensive because they believed that mothers must eat healthy in order to breastfeed. They suggested, as we've heard before, that social support, emotional, tangible, informational, and encouragement to African American mothers and their social networks is needed to promote a breastfeeding-friendly environment. Now, this next study was conducted in New York State by the New York State WIC program, and they used a intervention called You Can Do It, which is a tailored breastfeeding counseling plan targeted towards attitudes, social and professional support, again, and confidence improving exclusive breastfeeding. The women enrolled in their study during the first trimester who intended to breastfeed or who were undecided and continued in WIC after delivery comprised one baseline cohort of 688 women. And then there were two intervention cohorts. Before an intervention, a screening tool was given to women consenting to the tool. It's called the Breastfeeding Attrition Prediction Tool. And 362 women consented to the tool and the subsequent intervention, and 408 declined. The consenting women received multiple counseling tailored to their individual screening results throughout pregnancy and were contacted immediately following delivery. What they found out through multiple logistic regression was that at day 7 and day 30, exclusive breastfeeding was significantly higher among the women receiving the intervention than either the non-intervention or the original baseline cohort. And furthermore, that non-Hispanic Black and Hispanic women in the intervention cohort achieved significantly higher exclusive breastfeeding rates at 30 and 60 days compared to those in the non-intervention or the baseline cohort. The next couple of articles that I'm looking at the time, we have time for this. Next couple of article papers highlight engagement of WIC programs and with other agencies that enhance the this particular paper, Rachel, I'm having trouble having this stay. Okay. This particular paper looked at the engagement of WIC in the state of Tennessee. Tennessee has a Tennessee breastfeeding hotline, which is a 24/7 telephone lactation support program. They take initial information on the moms, and during a study period, they were contacted by 366 WIC participants and over 1,300 non-participants. And what they found, the differences between the questions that were asked by the two groups, were that WIC participants tended to call more likely with issues related to milk expression, supplemental nutrition, and lactation concerns such as not making enough milk, breast pumps and rentals, or milk storage, whereas the non-WIC mothers needed assistance addressing breast-related problems, such as breast engorgement or nipple and breast pain, and also about anxiety about the infant refusing to nurse. The authors of this particular paper suggested that collaborating with outside agencies outside of the WIC clinic might help improve breastfeeding. This study, which was conducted in Dallas, was a collaboration between the City of Dallas WIC and three local hospitals. Hospitals who are trying to achieve the breastfeeding-friendly initiative status have to provide, have to go through 10 steps in order to get that certification. Step two is particularly challenging because it requires nursing staff, in addition to having many hours of didactic information, they need 5 hours of clinical experience. So what the City of Dallas WIC program did was, with these three hospitals, created a training using practical techniques and information. It was done in a workshop format, and this way making it available so that the nurses could be certified in receiving these extra 5 hours of clinical experience. And after initiation of this particular collaboration, 1,600 workers have been trained. One of the three hospitals actually received baby-friendly designation, and all have increased breastfeeding rates. Again, suggesting that a collaborative effort of WIC programs with other outside agencies might enhance breastfeeding and exclusive breastfeeding amongst WIC participants. A couple of gems are highlighted in this supplement, and this one talks about a prenatal breastfeeding education curriculum. And the next one, these are so out of order. This one is the development of implementation of a social media toolkit that can be used by both WIC and other agencies external to the WIC program. I am going to just check real quick and see if there's any more questions. Let's see. There are a couple more questions. One is related, this is to Dr. Whaley. My question is related to the odds ratio shared at the end. I wonder if you're considered estimating the cost savings of breastfeeding reduction of WIC of childhood obesity.
Oh gosh, I hope that person identified themselves and wants to do that with us, because that's really, I think, a wonderful next step of all of this work is, particularly right now, it's really tying every investment that we make, every dollar we invest in WIC, with the savings that come from those investments. I am not an economist, but if whoever asked that question knows a good one, please send that in through the question box.
Okay, I want to just add one thing, and then I'm gonna give both speakers an opportunity to provide any last minute statements. I love this quote by Maya Angelou. Do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better. I'd like to remind everyone that a woman's decision to exclusively breastfeed, partially breastfeed, or not breastfeed at all is simply not a choice of how to feed her infant. The choice isn't simple. A woman must consider the impact not only on the health of her infant and herself. She must think about the familial, social, cultural, and economical consequences of her decision. This may be particularly difficult for women enrolled in WIC. I'd like to remind us all to be respectful for accepting women's infant feeding decisions while providing those who have chosen to breastfeed the best protection, support, and encouragement possible. Do you have any last statements, either one of our speakers?
Well, I'd just like to follow up on that perspective. I feel that WIC has done a great job at promoting exclusive breastfeeding and bringing resources to bear on that in the current packages. But to achieve that full respect, it does require recognizing that women have different desires about breastfeeding, and those desires may in no way correspond to national public health goals. But that by getting women started with breastfeeding at the partial level, if that's their first baby and that's what works for them at the time, the next time around they'll be more confident that they can breastfeed and they may well go to exclusive. But if they can make it through a month of partial breastfeeding, they still have a choice to move to exclusive. They can stay partial or they can move to formula feeding. But all of this is about helping mothers to make the milk that their babies need and make sure the babies get it.
Dr. Whaley?
Thank you for the opportunity. I echo both of your summary comments and really wanted to thank JNUB for thinking of doing a special issue on WIC and breastfeeding, and to USDA FNS for finding some funds to support this work. I think this whole issue is a very exciting one for the WIC community. I'll speak for myself, but I think I speak for others in the WIC community that there's wonderful work going on at WIC, and the more help we can get to document that work, the better. So, you know, I think this is for those folks listening in who are from inside of WIC programs, you know, I hope this provides some motivation to really look at the data that you collect every day and think about how we might use it to document impact. And for those folks from outside of WIC, to consider partnerships with your local WIC program so that we can continue to do this kind of research and move it forward. So thank you.
And I would like to plug that those of you who do this research or have practice or gems to report, to consider submitting to JNEB, and even to consider becoming a member of the Society for Nutrition Education and Behavior. We have a few remaining minutes, and I think, Rachel, I'm going to turn it back to you for some last housekeeping efforts. I'd like, again, to thank both of our speakers for their excellent presentation. I'd like to thank all the people who submitted papers, all the reviewers who helped us through the supplement. It's a major undertaking, and again, to FNS for providing funding for the supplement and this experience. So, Rachel, it's yours.
Thank you, Madeline. Yeah, and thank you to our presenters today. Just a reminder, there'll be a survey when I close the webinar, and we appreciate your feedback. And if you can watch for an email by the end of the day on Thursday, we'll send out the recording, the slides again, and we'll make that correction for Dr. Whaley. And then the CEU certificate will be linked to that email as well. We appreciate your attendance today, and for future SNEB webinars, please look on the website. We will be doing a journal club again this fall, which is a weekly presentation on Mondays from JNEB researchers. So thank you for attending today, and we hope to see you in a future SNEB webinar.